More world leaders congratulated Ibrahim Raisi for winning Iran's presidential election as his supporters celebrate his victory. Iran summons Britain's ambassador to protest violent incidents targeting its expatriates voting in the presidential election. The Yemeni army downs an American spy drone over Marib province, where heavy fighting is underway between Ansarullah fighters and Saudi-backed forces. Good to have you with us. Let's begin at this bulletin with an update on Iran's presidential election. Ibrahim Raisi has won Iran's 2021 presidential election by a landslide victory. The cleric now has become the eighth Iranian president since the establishment of the Islamic Republic in 1979.
The short but intense presidential race in Iran came to an end on Saturday, with principalist flag bearer Ibrahim Raisi announced as the next president. Out of some 29 million votes cast in the election, Raisi secured more than 17.9 million votes to win the election by a comfortable margin against his reformist rival Abdel Nasser Hemati, who stood third in the race with less than 2.5 million votes.
Mr. Ibrahim Raisi is chosen by the people as the winner and president with 17,926,345 votes. Mr. Mohsen Rezai Miqat got 3,412,712 votes. Mr. Abdel Nasser Hemati, with 2,427,201 votes, is in the third place. Mr. Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, with 999,718 votes, is in the last place.
President-elect Raisi was the chief of Iran's judiciary from 2019 until he won the election. The Muslim cleric ran with the slogan of popular administration, Strong Iran, with a focus on uprooting corruption in the executive branch, fighting poverty, creating jobs, containing inflation and housing prices.
I will make changes to the circulars that allow astronomical salaries for certain managers. This way we can help promote justice.
President-elect Raisi will take over power from outgoing President Hassan Rouhani with a host of unresolved issues. On top of them is an economy affected by the U.S. sanctions. That's a large part tied to the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal. On the campaign trail, Raisi stood out as an outspoken critic of Rouhani's policies. He believed that the ultimate cure for the economy must be explored inside the country.
Mr. Raisi comes from the principalist camp, which believes that any talks with the West must take place from a position of a strength, unlike the weak stance adopted by the outgoing administration, which has made the negotiations erosive. Raisi would continue the Vienna talks, but he would tell the other side, hey, if you want a deal, let's have it. If not, we'll continue with our remedial nuclear steps.
Some 60 million Iranians were eligible to vote in this year's election. The Interior Ministry put the final voter turnout at 48.8%. The polls opened an hour earlier at 7 a.m. on Friday, and voting was extended several times until 2 a.m. on Saturday, both to accommodate the flow of voters and prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Ibrahim Raisi has promised to recover the Iranian economy and strengthen it in the face of sanctions. Now it's up to him to make good on his promises and bring about the economic change that every Iranian is now hoping for. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Now, fireworks lighten up the skies over several Iranian cities as supporters of President-elect took to the streets to celebrate his victory in the Friday election. People took to the streets, mosques, and other public places to express their joy at Raisi's landslide win. He garnered some 18 million out of a total 29 million votes cast on election day, becoming the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. His rival, Mohsen Rezai, came in a distant second with 3.4 million votes, followed by the other two candidates. The president-elect has 4 years to deliver on his campaign pledges, which include fighting poverty and improving the economic situation. In the meantime, congratulations are pouring in for Ibrahim Raisi on winning Iran's presidential election. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro expressed hope for further boosting of ties and cooperation between Caracas and Tehran. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel has wished success for Raisi in performing his duties. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega also expressed deepest congratulations on behalf of his nation. Leaders of other countries, including Russia, Turkey, Iraq, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the UAE, already offered felicitations to the Iranian president-elect. Let's now take a look at the president-elect's background and what he has promised to do in the next 4 years.
Ibrahim Raisi is a prominent Iranian cleric. He has held several key posts in the judiciary since 1979 Islamic Revolution. He was a prosecutor of the cities of Karaj, Hamedan, as well as the capital, Tehran. Raisi also served as first deputy chief of justice of Iran and attorney general. In March 2016, Raisi became the chairman of Astan Quds Razavi, and in 2019, he was appointed as a judiciary chief, a post he currently serves. In May, the prominent cleric announced his candidacy. He ran on a platform of tackling economic problems such as poverty, unemployment, and inflation.
My administration will have no red line in fighting corruption. The root cause of injustices in the executive branch of the government must be dried up. The banking, tax, import, and export systems must be reformed.
On the Iranian economy, Raisi finds the current conditions unacceptable since people are not able to predict their financial situation due to constant fluctuations. He has unveiled a plan on economic recovery.
My economic plan can be summed up in three main points. Of course, there are other important issues I will address later if time allows. But now I would like to mention these three principles, which are the most important ones. The first one is overhauling governance and fighting corruption, inefficiency, and discrimination. The second point concerns supporting underprivileged families and social strata. And the third is increasing production and boosting businesses.
Regarding the 2015 nuclear deal, Raisi says he has set an agenda for securing the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. He highlighted the need for strengthening the economy in the face of sanctions or any other trauma that might afflict the economy.
The Iranian nation should do all in its power to confront those who seek to breach the Iranian nation's rights and pursue the removal of sanctions. Definitely, action should be taken to bring about the removal of the sanctions.
On foreign policy, Raisi has vowed to expand ties with countries across the globe, with neighbors to be given priority. Raisi has promised to define an important mission for Iranian embassy, that is to engage in economic diplomacy in respective countries. He has been elected as the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. He says people's trust in the administration needs to be restored.
Tehran has summoned British ambassador to protest violent incidents targeting its expatriates who showed up at polling stations in the UK to participate in presidential election. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says the violence was perpetrated by anti-revolutionary, anti-democratic, and terrorist elements insulting the voters and Iranian embassy staff. Said Khatibzadeh said that the incidents included the beating of a female voter in Birmingham. He said that Iran would launch legal proceedings against those it holds responsible. Iranian media reported several incidents on Friday on the sidelines of the vote organized for Iranian citizens in Britain, the United States, Australia, and elsewhere. Tina Taylor says that adversaries in Iran are trying to undermine and dismantle Iranian democracy by attacking expats who are trying to vote abroad.
Essentially, world organizations, political leaders trying to undermine the democratic process inside Iran, and then by virtue of that, trying to undermine that process when, as in any other nation, you have your embassy and your consulates and special places that allow your citizens to come and enjoy their right and express their preference for a candidate of their choice, when you've already built up an anti-narrative to that, those who are already in the pockets of Iran's enemies will see that as a sign that they're being emboldened and that they will be protected by this. And just specifically, even with our own crews who are covering this event, there were a lot of very vocal members of the ragtag dissident community who were essentially organized. This wasn't just people coming down to a polling station to an area to express their dissatisfaction with a particular candidate or with a particular system. This was a coordinated setup situation.
The Yemeni army says it's shut down an American spy drone over the province of Marib. Army spokesman General Yahya Saria said the drone, known as Scan Eagle, was spotted and hit while flying over Mashjah region in Marib province. The UAV was brought down using a land-to-air missile. The spokesman also underlined the fact that the Yemeni armed forces will not hold back any effort to defend the country's skies against aggressive activity. Well, they've shut down several American spy drones in Saudi Arabia, and some of its regional allies, backed by Washington, launched a war on Yemen in 2015. The war has left tens of thousands of people dead, many of them women and children. Meantime, Yemen's political leadership blames the UN for apathy toward the continued Saudi violation against children in the country. Officials say that the UN should play its role to lift the Saudi blockade that causes more deaths among children instead of blacklisting the Ansarla movement. Abdullah Tifel Weshel reports.
Yemen's Ansarla movement blamed the United Nations for the Saudi atrocities committed against Yemeni children. The movement said the UN has always been providing the political cover-up for the Saudi war crimes. This came after the United Nations added the Ansarullah movement to its blacklist of groups for violating children's rights.
We were not surprised by this decision because the UN had removed the name of Saudi Arabia from its blacklist of the groups violating children's rights. The United Nations have not taken any real steps to protect the rights of Yemeni children who die every day due to continued blockade on food, medicine, and fuel. I believe that this is a resounding scandal for the Secretary General of the UN, who began his second term with this decision.
The member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, dismissed as baseless the UN accusation, saying it did not refer to an investigation on the ground as the movement has demanded. Meanwhile, the Minister of Information said the UN has turned a blind eye to the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemenis, which causes the death of tens of Yemeni children on a daily basis.
This classification wasn't based on realistic data. We used to have the United Nations as a political cover for the war on Yemen and the killing of more Yemeni women and children, whether because of a continuous Saudi blockade or because of the airstrikes of Saudi fighter jets. This decision revealed to the world the true face of the United Nations, that it serves the agenda of the countries funding the UN.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and turned the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the United Nations blacklisting of Ansarullah is politically motivated and has no relation to the humanitarian situation in Yemen. They believe that the UN must take real actions against the Saudi blockade if it has real intentions to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Taliban militant group says it's committed to ongoing peace talks in Qatar amid concerns over the slow progress in the negotiations. The Taliban's political office said that the group believes in resolving issues through mutual understanding. Peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban resumed in Qatar last Tuesday after hitting an impasse in April. Officials fear the discussions are heading for a new deadlock. They say the Taliban need to submit a written peace proposal to be used as a basis for substantive talks. This amid a rising violence across Afghanistan as the U.S. is preparing to pull out its remaining troops from the country on September 11th. India has registered its lowest daily coronavirus cases in nearly 3 months. It reported 58,000 new infections in the past day, bringing the caseload to nearly 30 million. Overall fatalities hovering around 387,000. The new daily infections in India dropped recently after a surge in April and May. Daily infections reached their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. India has the second largest caseload and the third highest death toll in the world. Munawwar Zaman says that a recent decline in COVID cases in India is encouraging signs, but health experts are warning that the third wave is inevitable.
The cases have started dropping significantly since last 2 weeks. And if we remember, in April, that was an utter mayhem across the country. The new cases have declined in a tremendous way, and the death toll has also declined, which is showing some signs of joy for the country's people. And the country has started opening up, which means there is more economic activity and people can start going to work. And at the same time, people feel this is a new life, because the lockdowns has devastated the livelihood of millions across India, and a lot of people are facing acute poverty and at the same time problems of unemployment. Well, now the biggest challenge here in India is that many health experts and scientists are warning that the third wave is inevitable, and it is very close, approximately 4 to 6 weeks away. And they're warning people that they should not take things lightly.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. As you know, we've been speaking about God's wisdom and His justice. We said that wisdom means to create something or to make something or do something in such a way that the thing lasts and is strong and is not easily destructible. Sometimes wisdom is used as a characteristic of knowledge. It means the best possible knowledge of the best possible thing that can be known. Justice refers to the fact that something is done in the way that's suitable to it. It's performed in the place that's suitable to it, the time that's suitable to it. Contrary to justice is oppression, and contrary to wisdom is ignorance. We said that God Almighty is wise, and He's just because He's all perfect, and therefore He has to have these perfections, and also He created these perfections. He granted them to beings in this universe, so therefore He has to possess them. We also said that a being that lacks these perfections lacks them due to certain imperfections, such as ignorance, stinginess, or weakness of the will, and so on and so forth. The question we want to address today is this: are there any verses in the Holy Quran which point, or the traditions of the infallibles, alayhim wassalam, which point to reasons for God's justice? Answer this question is yes, there is. For example, well, let's mention a number of examples for this. These verses of the Holy Quran and these traditions point to exactly what we talked about earlier, and the relation between perfection, God's being all perfect, and His having these perfections. For example, in Surah Ali Imran, verse 18, God Almighty says the following: Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Shahidallahu annahu la ilaha illahu wal malaikatu wa ulul ilmi qa'iman bil qist. God testifies that there is no God but Him, and do the angels, the possessors of knowledge, qa'iman bil qist. This word qa'iman bil qist means that God Almighty is just. Right. Because this justice is referred to in an absolute sense, it includes the three categories of justice that we talked about in some of our previous sessions, such as cosmological justice, which refers to the fact that God creates everything in the way that's suitable to it; legislative justice, which means that He gives all of the commands and regulations which are necessary and suitable for society and human beings; and judicial justice, which means that He gives rewards to those who deserve it and punishes those who deserve it. Another verse of the Holy Quran which points towards God's justice is the 47th verse of Surah Al-Anbiya. In this verse, Allah says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَنَّزَأُ الْمَوَازِينَ الْقِسْتِ لَيَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ. God says that on the day of resurrection, we will place the scales of justice. What is the result of this? God mentions the result of this and says, فَلَا تُزْلَمْ نَفْسٌ شَيْئًا. No soul will be wronged in the least. This verse specifically refers to God's judicial justice and the fact that He will give rewards to those who deserve them and punish those who deserve them. Of course, it's necessary to mention an important point here, and that's this: that judicial justice is also a manifestation of cosmological justice, because these rewards that God gives to these beings, or punishes them, or these punishments that He gives to beings, are things that He creates. So in a sense, this is also a manifestation of cosmological justice. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining God's justice and His wisdom in the traditions and in the verses of the Holy Quran. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part, we saw how Lorna Taychostyuk made her first trip to Iraq just before the start of the war to reveal the humanity of Iraq's citizens through her photojournalism. Consequently, her attempt to enlighten the American public turned to controversy as Fox News broadcasters called her efforts, quote, villainous and even bordering on treason, and accused her of aiding and abetting the enemy on the brink of war. But Lorna was never intimidated by such words. Instead, she continued her efforts to report stories that go beyond mainstream media coverage, and during her trips to Iraq, she endeavors to get as close to the people as possible and find her way to the ordinary people in the streets of Iraq. Well, stay with us for the second part of our documentary.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and we were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and north, east, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
We flew back, and we spent 6 weeks living in an unprotected hotel, talking to as many Iraqis as possible, traveling in taxi cabs and in people's cars, people who started to befriend us after a while. This particular camp kind of adopted me because I would keep going back. A lot of journalists go to Iraq, they get the sexy story, they go home, they write about it, they never go back. These people, I usually go visit everyone. I try and visit everyone I've spoken to, like, you know, different people who I've had conversations with on each trip to see how they're doing, get a recap. They invited me to their eldest son's wedding, and this was wild. I mean, we had my interpreter and I and the videographer arrived at this SWAT camp. And all these women were all dolled up in this back room, and they put the Arabic music on, and they have the kerchiefs, and we're doing the dance, and we're just having like this blast. The Iraqi people are good-looking people. They love to look good. They're very fashionable. This is in a SWAT camp. These people are obviously very poor, but they're still, if they have only one set of clothes, they wash it every night. They go out, and they love to look good. Happiest when I'm there, you know, really, because you know you're doing your work. I feel like you're making some progress. You're helping the world a little bit.
Don't you think this building needs some work?
Yeah.
It's a big surprise. He's 90 years old. He's still working.
I think of those young and old people who we've impacted each other. They've taught me so much about their culture, about life in Iraq. They've allowed me an insider's glimpse.
I really had a great day. You will never believe the miracle that happened. We were waiting for a taxi across the street from the hotel. Suddenly, this taxi rolled slowly over to us, as if by magic. And the guy driving was the man in the photo walking with crutches with one leg. And he remembered me taking his photo, so we made arrangements for him to come to the hotel and see his picture. Did you know that at the last minute, I grabbed my box of huge 20 by 24 photos? Yes, and I did have them here with me, and I can show people the photos. I gotta go now. My battery got fried yesterday, and the electricity came on. I had no surge protector hooked to it. Much love to you, my sweetie. I'm missing you all the day long and talking to you in my heart. I miss you and love you very much. love Mama.
I have Commando Mommy photos, Liz.
Where?
I'm looking for them right now.
Commando.
We went over to Olive's house and they wrapped me in a...
I want to be your president for 4 more years to make our future brighter and better for every one of our citizens. I want to be your president for 4 more years to make our country safe.
The Republican message is going to be, these are dangerous times, and President Bush will protect you.
And, you know, this is what we should be doing, and taking it to whatever degree we have to take it to. Getting arrested is not such a big thing when people are dying.
If we are a representative democracy and we supposedly have control over our government, what are we going to do about it?
Attendance is estimated between 100,000 and 300,000 people, though no official figures have been released. Overall, the march, peaceful, except for some altercations. So far, police report 134 arrests.
2005, I went back for the first election, and I almost got killed a couple of times. I was only actually in the country for 10 days, and I didn't go back for a couple of years because I was terrified. I was caught in a crossfire shootout, and, you know, here I am, an unarmed American woman traveling, you know, with cameras. And I would think, I must have been crazy coming here and walking on these streets.
Every night at the hotel, darkness would come, and you'd hear, like, the machine gun fire out in the street or handgun fire out in the street, or sometimes they were, like, fighting each other. I don't know what was going on. Everywhere we went, there were guns. You can hear, like, them clicking the guns in the background. They're loading them, checking the clips. There's nothing like the sound of a Kalashnikov being loaded.
It was kind of like, oh, attitude. You're not killing us today. And if you want to kill us, go ahead. Try. It was like, it was so intense. Like, gunfire broke out at one point, and no one left. Like, people refused to move, even though there was someone was shooting a gun at them. They told us, like, we went to the first polling place. They said, no, you cannot take any pictures of the National Guard or the police. So, yes, I'm not going to break the rules. Soon, everybody wants me to take their picture. The policeman in charge, he said, here, take my picture. He took someone's kid. He was kissing the kid. He said, I want you to take my picture.
Now, remember, this last trip was very dangerous for me. I had to wear hijab the entire time and my abaya. My camera bag was a hidden woman's bag where I had, you know, and I had a press pass. I was even afraid to show that at times that someone would take me out. There were over 250 political parties. Here's the election ballot boxes. People came in, they voted. And that's the other thing, a lot of political parties suddenly popping out of the woodwork, you know, because, oh, now we have democracy. Do we know what that means? Now we have freedom. Do we know what that means? I mean, it was a very beautiful, exciting time to see these people emerging from this snuffed-out dictatorship state to be just thinking about, now we're free. The first 3 weeks there, I didn't talk. I didn't write a word. I was too afraid to, because I had to get my mind on it. I had to wrap my mind around it, and I had to open to what they were saying and not what I was feeling, or not what I went there thinking.
No one is interested in the truth. So did I want to hear that half the people in Iraq were, you know, certainly large numbers of people love Bush? No, I didn't want to hear that.
We are no killers, we are no terrorists, we are just looking for peace and beautiful life.
So what do you think should happen now? Point, I had two choices. I could have submerged myself and refused to hear them and to seek out people who supported my belief system, or I could listen to what they were saying and try to understand why they were saying it. And that's what I decided to do. And it was painful, and it was hard, and it was shocking to me. But the bottom line is, it's very complex. In fact, the first article I wrote was called Making Peace with All the Truths. It's not one truth. It's a multifaceted truth. And it may not make sense, and it's not black and white, and it's not right or wrong. It is complicated. But, you know, it doesn't fit into a sound bite, so we can't use it. And that's where I'm at. I don't know what I'm going to do. All I kept thinking the last 3 weeks I was there is I want to come home and plant my garden. Politics, the world, war.
Knowing what you know today, would you do the same thing all over again?
I think it is doubtful that without the weapons of mass destruction case, the President, the Congress, the United Nations, and those who joined us in the conflict, the British, the Italians, the Spanish, the Australians would have found a persuasive enough case to support a decision to go to war.
I want our troops home. I want all this. I want all the children of the world home and not in a war situation, okay? But we can't get the troops home now because we've opened up Pandora's box and people's lives are at risk. And it's about time. I mean, the left doesn't want to take responsibility for anything. The right doesn't want to take responsibility. We have to take responsibility. I have, as an American, I have to take responsibility in my country. And I'm not going to abandon these people who I have gotten to know and who are telling me we're afraid that if you guys leave, the shit's going to hit the fan.
You classify your work, journalism, as anti-mainstream or alternative.
I don't think they have a category for me in. I went to Iraq to bring home the face of the Iraqi people so that the people in my country can see who they were killing and maybe think, these are beautiful people, why would we want to kill them? Infantile idealism.
As a journalist, what are you going to do? Are you prepared for dying?
You can't go there unless you accept that you may not.
My name is Lorna Tychostop. I'm an editor, writer, and photojournalist. I've been working in and out of Iraq now since February 2003. I'm going to continue to name the names of the fallen from the state of New Mexico. Specialist Christopher A. Merville, age 26. Sergeant Moses Daniel Rocca, age 19.
The first time I read, the first 19-year-old, I had to like wait a whole minute because I didn't want to. You know, I had a
Private, first class, William C. Ramirez, age 19. Sergeant
Tommy L. Gray, age 34. Jaffer Hashim Majid, age 13. Wissam Hadi Duari, age 11. Daoud Kiss, age 55. Muhammad Agab, no age given. This is exactly where my photos belong, because people will see them. Ahmed Al Rifai, age 13. The face of the Iraqi people has found a home.
At some point, I realized I didn't know enough to truly report in depth on the issues that I was learning about. So I went back to school. I found a master's program at NYU in global affairs. And by that time, I had begun doing consulting work for an Iraqi NGO called Nature Iraq. Their work was to baseline the environmental conditions in the country while violence was still occurring. And I just thought that was phenomenal, and I chose that as my thesis topic. I graduated at the end of 2009, and shortly thereafter scored, you know, what I thought was my dream job, and working as a communications and outreach specialist for a USAID project in Baghdad. Their work had to do with training over 100,000 Iraqi civil servants in how to rebuild their country.
For nearly 9 years, our nation has been at war in Iraq. I'm proud to finally say these two words, and I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home.
You know, my son called me a couple of days after 9/11 and said, hey, Mom, me and Mikey, we're going to sign up. We're going to go get them. And I was like, get who? As my, you know, heart stopped. And he said, we're going to get them, the people who did this. And I said, well, who did this? We don't know who did this. Who are you going to go get? Don't you think you should wait till we know who did this before you go get them? Sometimes I think I'm the one who went, so they wouldn't have to. Because I would rather it be me than them. I think I put a lot of faces where people had friendly, happy, family faces to what people previously thought of as terrorists and scary and dark.
think I was able to show a lot of people that, you know, we're not that much different. We all want basically the same things. We want a nice job so we can have a nice vacation. We want dinner on the table with our family at the end of the day. And we want to live in peace.
Lorna's haunting photographs and poignant stories enable her audience to share the tragedy, the struggle, the triumph of the Iraqi people. And they raise larger questions about the war, a war that was never necessary, which could have been stopped if only warmongering governments heard the voice of the people. And that's it, everyone, for this week on Aperture. Until another episode right here on Aperture, goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Dear brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته You are welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Now, dear brothers and sisters, we are going to talk about envy. Envy is one of the most destructive evils. Envy itself is a product of pride. It is a product of greed. It is a product of anger. And, of course, in the previous episode, I discussed greed. And greed is as an important evil, a fundamental evil, as envy. And both of them are destructive evils. They are discussed within morality. Of course, every evil has some attraction to catch the eyes of mankind, except envy. Okay, envy is a disgusting moral quality. Now, there is a saying from the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says, Al-ayn haqqun yahdhuruha ash-shaytanu wa hasadu ibn Adam. Evil eye exists for sure. Satan and man's envy call it to action. It has no immediate or long-term benefit, no comfort, no sweetness. On the contrary, an envious man burns his own heart, wastes his own time, thinking why God has given such bounties to my neighbor, and keeps awake the whole night, imagining that neighbor as ruined, because he is envious. He does not want his neighbors to have what they have. He keeps thinking, and he's always restless. But all this wishful thinking affects nobody but his own psychology and his own health. It is his health and it is his mind and his psychology that is affected, because there is fire burning in him. It is a fire that burns the fire maker only. الغل والحسد يأكلان الحسنات كما تأكل النار الحطب. Envy and hatred ruin all the good, just as fire swallows firewood.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
According to Imam Ali, you know, Imam Ali actually draws a kind of parallel between fire and hasad, envy. Hasad is like a fire that burns all the good deeds that you have done, just as a fire burns the firewood, you know. So it's important to be mindful of envy. It is so destructive, and it destroys all the good deeds and all the good actions that a person does. Now, the inner layers of envy are worth studying. Why a man indulges in this most futile exercise? Does he think that God should consult him before bestowing his grace upon someone else? Does he imagine that he is a partner of God and that nothing, especially no good, should happen on the earth without his consent? Of course, this is what, if you look at the interior of an envious person's mind and heart, you will find this tendency in him. If it were not so, then why so much heart burning on the decisions of God? If someone is bestowed with blessings and bounties, why should another person start envying him? Does such a person think that God's grace is a limited quantity which must be taken away from one to give to another? If not so, then why envy your relatives or friends? Why not ask God to bestow his grace upon you also, as he has done with them? Envy ruined Satan when he began burning his heart on the status of Adam. It destroyed Cain when he became envious of his own brother Abel. Therefore, the Holy Prophet has said, envy eats away the good deeds as fire eats away the wood. Islam has prescribed a medicine for this spiritual sickness, that is love. Love is the medicine through which this ailment can be cured. Islam shows the way towards the love of God through the love of His creatures. The best person in the eyes of God is that who is the best for the creatures of God, who is not envious towards the creatures of God. And Islam also emphasizes that the real grace and bounty is not that of this world. The bounty and grace in the life hereafter is the real one. Therefore, you should not make the comforts of this world your ultimate goal, the ultimate goal of your life. Your aim must be the eternal grace of God. The grace cannot be obtained by envy. It may be obtained by love. Love of God, love of His Prophet, love of the family of the Prophet, love of your parents and your relatives, love of your neighbors, love of your brothers in religion, love of your fellow human beings. These are some aspects of love which are stressed by Islam to make a man free from envy and to make a man free from spite. And just as the Holy Prophet said, envy actually eats away the good deeds as fire eats away the wood. الحسد يأكل الحسنات كما يأكل النار الحطب. So the meaning of this prophetic tradition is clear, of course. Envy is a kind of a fire that burns the person who is envious. And as long as he keeps having this evil quality, he will be restless. He will not live a comfortable life. He will have pain. He will have misery. And he will not live an easy life. Let's fight this evil quality and let the love conquer envy and be a real Muslim. Inshallah, we will continue our discussion on morality in this program for a better life. Inshallah, in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is on a need.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.